Good evening, everyone. I think it's time that we start after letting everyone chance to be here. The discussion will be in English, so if anyone needs translation, we provide simultaneous translation during the whole discussion, and you may take your earphones. Okay, and it seems that we are ready. So I am very proud to welcome our guests and you here. And first, some organizational introduction. That this meeting, this discussion is organized within three big programs. One is our Czytelnia Polin, which I haven't prepared English translation for reading room Pauline. And also within the seminar of the program Genealogies of Memory in Central and Eastern Europe. And so we have co-host organizations, which is the Social Memory Laboratory at Warsaw University, European Network Remembrance and Solidarity, and Cultura Liberalna, liberal culture. And the event is also organized within, and thanks to the grant we received from the Global Education Outreach Program. And so I'm very happy to welcome our distinguished guest, Michael Rothberg, and to discuss about his just translated book into Polish, Pamięć Wielokierunkowa, multi-directional memory, and we will be talking together with Katarzyna Bojarska and Adam Lipschitz, and I will be introducing these guests step by step. First of all, Professor Michael Rothberg, who is chair in Holocaust Studies and professor of English and Comparative Literature at the University of California. And his fields are Holocaust Studies, Trauma and Memory Studies, Critical Theory and Cultural Studies, Postcolonial Studies and Contemporary Literatures. He is author of Traumatic Realism, The Demands of Holocaust Representation, and of numerous co-edited volumes. He's also on the editorial board of the journals Memory Studies and Studies in American Jewish Literature, and he's also on the advisory board of the recently funded Memory Studies Association. Currently, he's working on the book The Implicated Subject Beyond Victims and Perpetrators. So I propose for the discussion that you first talk for about 5 minutes about your book, about the, what was the genesis of the idea, what does the MOOC, I will say in a second a bit more, then I will ask our two other guests to say something more. And then I would like to open the floor for discussion with you, because I see on the audience many distinguished scholars, many people who will have much to add to the discussion, and we are very happy about it. The book that we are discussing here today, I think, without exaggeration, we can say that this is a milestone in memory studies in the recent 10 years, if no more. And it is a very important book also within the, what Astrid Earle has called the third wave in memory studies. Mm. I would like to ask you maybe to develop the idea when you will be talking about your book. I think this is the context for discussing it, where she sees memory as encounter between cultures, between groups, not memory as bounded to one group. You are starting also with the idea of the screen memory, and you are developing it in the direction as to not standing for rivaling memories, but rather for multi-directional memories. What does it mean? And the floor is yours.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Before my 5 minutes start ticking, I do want to say thank you to everybody who made this event possible, Margojata Pakir, Kasia Boyarska, and Adam Lipschitz for taking part, all the institutions as well. I'm especially grateful to Kasia, of course, because she did a really... For me, an amazing thing, which is translating this book into Polish, which I'm so honored to have appear here in this language. And that's a lot of work, or I can only imagine that it was a lot of work. And so I really, really appreciate that. And I really appreciate your role in bringing me to Poland for the last couple of days. We had an interesting event also in Krakow yesterday. So it's wonderful to be here. I wanted to start by saying that it's also very, very powerful and really moving for me to be in this very spot where we are today. Not just the museum, but this place in Poland, because in Warsaw, because in some senses my book began here. And let me tell you what I mean by that. The first part of the book that I wrote, it's not the first chapter in the published version, it's, I believe, the third chapter, but the first thing I wrote before I even came up with the phrase multidirectional memory was an essay about the great African-American scholar W.E.B. Du Bois and a trip that he took, a visit that he made to Warsaw in 1949, which he then wrote about in 1952. And ordinarily, when I talk about Du Bois's visit and what he wrote about it, I will show pictures of what Warsaw looked like in 1949, but I obviously don't have to do that here. You have one downstairs, and of course you all know this much better than I do. But this became really important moment for me because of the way that Du Bois responded to it, and 3 years later wrote about it in a short essay called The Negro and the Warsaw Ghetto. And it was through my reading of Du Bois's essay that I started to think about memory in a new way. We can talk more about that as we go. But I wanted to just read a couple of excerpts. So what he saw, of course, was the destruction, complete destruction of the city, especially the complete destruction of what had been the ghetto. And he also arrived the year after Rappaport's monument to the ghetto heroes had been unveiled. So he saw that monument as well. And in my reading, at least, the monument was also important to him as well as this landscape of ruins. And he wrote then in 1952, "I have seen something of human upheaval in this world. The screams and shots of a race riot in Atlanta, the marching of the Ku Klux Klan, the threat of courts and police, the neglect and destruction of human habitation. But nothing in my wildest imagination was equal to what I saw in Warsaw in 1949. And then he goes on, I want to read just one more short passage from this essay. He goes on to say then, okay, what was the effect of this, what he saw, the result of his visit? And particularly, he says, of my view of the Warsaw Ghetto and of the monument, was not so much clearer, this is a quotation, was not so much clearer understanding of the Jewish problem in the world as it was a real and more complete understanding of the Negro problem. In the first place, the problem of slavery, emancipation, and caste in the United States was no longer in my mind a separate and unique thing as I had so long conceived it. It was not even solely a matter of color and physical and racial characteristics, which was particularly a hard thing for me to learn, since for a lifetime the color line had been a real and efficient cause of misery. The race problem in which I was interested cut across lines of color and physique and belief and status, and was a matter of cultural patterns, perverted teaching, and human hate and prejudice, which reached all sorts of people and caused endless evil to all men." So that was Du Bois in 1952, reflecting on his 1949 visit to Warsaw. And what I took from that essay was what I think is a really extraordinary vision of solidarity across identities, identities that are often pitted against each other, in this case, Black and Jewish, but also a grasp of the relationality of different histories, right? That he understands African-American history now in a new way because of his confrontation with Jewish history or the remains, the legacies of a certain Jewish history that he saw in Warsaw. And there's a kind of ethical principle that I derive from this that I think is, to me, is very, very important. And it's partly about relativizing your own position, right? Because that's what he does, right? He's confronted with something that he has not seen before. And it doesn't just give him a say, wow, here's this new thing I hadn't thought of. here's this new thing I hadn't thought of or seen that makes me think differently about myself. And it's that reflexive move, which I think is really, really important. So this ethical principle that he develops that then becomes key to what I'm going to later call multidirectional memory is to think comparatively about different histories, but to think them in a particular way in which you neither equate them, right? He doesn't say, you know, oh, the Jews, they suffered exactly what we suffered, we African Americans. So he doesn't equate different histories. He sees their differences. But he also doesn't, I think the language is really interesting, right? He also doesn't see his own history as separate and unique anymore. So he also doesn't radically separate histories from each other. And that's what I mean by relational. It's a vision of comparison or connection in which you are neither equating nor completely separating. And that became the basis for the way I think about memory in a more general sense. I think there's something more general that can be derived from this. So it took a little while to get to the concept of multidirectional memory, but in some ways this really was the starting point. But I want to say, to now say a little bit more generally about the book and about the argument of the book, if I can do that. It came out of not only this experience of reading Du Bois, but also the experience of writing a book on the Holocaust during the course of the 90s, in which at the same time genocides were going on in different parts of the world, in Rwanda, in the former Yugoslavia, and realizing that, you know, if I wanted to engage with genocide, I had to also engage with what was of the Holocaust, Nazi genocide of European Jews. For me, at least, it became very compelling. I had a compulsion also to think comparatively and relationally about that history and to ask, what does it mean in the face of the other forms of violence that are happening in my time? Something we could also think about today, of course. So there was that. And then when I looked at the way that people were talking about this question of how do you bring different histories of violence together, what I found was something that was, to me, both sort of disturbing as a human being, but I also thought was intellectually problematic. And that was a form of comparison that was really competition, right? A competition between different histories and memories of victimization. And there is competition in the world, and I'm not denying that at all in my book. Of course, I start out with a very competitive example. But what I tried to do in the book is to argue that the way that people think about competition of this sort, this competition of victims, is flawed in a fundamental way, that it misses the actual dynamic of the way that memories come together. And the way I came to describe this model of competitive memory was as a kind of zero-sum game, that people were thinking of memory as a zero-sum game. What I mean by that is this. If you did something like Du Bois and you're an African American and you try to address the Holocaust, you would often be accused of relativizing or even denying the Holocaust or denying the uniqueness of the Holocaust. You'd be accused of sort of taking away some of the importance of the Holocaust by bringing it together with this other history. At the same time, a lot of people, African Americans, Native Americans, in other contexts, other groups of peoples, I'm based in the US, of course, most of the time, so that's partly where I'm starting from. There was a sense from those people that there was too much emphasis on the Holocaust and that the Holocaust was taking up the public space that should have been used to address other more local histories. And that's where the screen memory issue came up. The Holocaust was often talked about as a screen memory, which was covering over more disturbing, more local histories, like the history of slavery in the United States, like the history of genocide of Native Americans in the United States. And I don't think that all memories are represented equally in the public sphere. I would never say anything like that. It's not what I'm saying in the book. But what I did come to think is that memory doesn't work according to this zero-sum logic. It doesn't work in the way that people who put forth this notion of competitive memory believe that it works. Rather, and this is what I ended up terming multidirectional memory, for me, the comparative, the bringing together of memories is a productive thing. It creates more memory, not less. So that what Du Bois does, for example, in bringing together African American history, Jewish history of Europe, is not to erase one or to push one out of view, but rather to create new kinds of memory, to create more kinds of memory. And that even, and he's doing something obviously very sympathetic, and that you can tell from the fragments I read, but even people who are sort of hostily saying, The Holocaust Museum in Washington is taking up space that really should go to a museum of slavery or a museum of genocide in the Americas. even those people articulating this very strong competitive position are actually using the Holocaust to produce new forms of memory of precisely those events that they're saying have not been represented. So the memory of one group becomes the opportunity to articulate the memory of another group. And it's that dynamic of interplay, of dialogue between different traditions that I came to think of as multidirectional memory. And if I could just make one or two more points, if that's okay, I know I've gone over 5 minutes. So that led to me in two directions. One was methodological and one was historical. The methodological point that I derived from that insight, which I still more or less think is true, is that if we want to investigate group memories, and that's mostly what I'm interested in, collective memories, group memories, public memories, cultural memories, whatever you want to call them, it actually doesn't matter that much to me, but not so much individual memories alone, but these group memories, if you want to investigate the group memory of, say, Jews or blacks or Poles or whoever, you have to do that comparatively. If you really want to understand the dynamics of Jewish memory, you have to see Jewish memory in relationship to the memory of surrounding and related cultures, right? If you want to understand the memory of African Americans, you have to see, for example, that African Americans use tropes that come from the Hebrew Bible, right? Exodus, for example, is really important in African American culture. That's just one example of the way that a certain specific black African diaspora memory is generated through contact with Jewish memory. Right, Jewish history, Jewish texts. And I think that this is, a kind of general methodological principle. Memory should be historicized in a dialogical, comparative way. And so then, the particular historical lesson I took from that was that I wanted to kind of, in some way, rewrite the history of Holocaust memory as it had come down to us. And what I do is not meant to be complete, and I'm not trying to say that this is the only way to tell the story of Holocaust memory at all. It's selective, for sure, but I think even in that selective retelling, you know, new things come into view. And so what I wanted to do, partly inspired by Du Bois, but also by other things that I then discovered, was to retell the history of Holocaust memory in dialogue with the memory of colonialism and slavery, of racism, and during the process of decolonization. Because one thing I realized was that the very period in which Holocaust memory emerged, right, it wasn't born right in 1945, and again in a public collective sense, but it's sometime, there's a kind of important turning point around the 1960s, most people say, in a lot of different national contexts. Again, I'm being selective, but I think it's true in different contexts. That's exactly the period of decolonization. That's when Europe is losing its empires, when the colonies are fighting back and demanding independence, and independence is happening. And so I tried to retell the history of Holocaust memory through its contact with these other histories.
Just yeah. To add very shortly, you already mentioned Du Bois' visit in Warsaw and the text The Negro and the Warsaw Ghetto, and you called the text in your book a performance taking place between different contexts, and you mentioned all these contexts of the colonization, Cold War in the United States, the Jewish left, the Afro-American movement and emancipation. What did you mean by performance?
By performance, that's interesting. I don't remember using that word, but I'm willing to admit that I probably did, and to explain why I did. I think what I was trying to suggest there is that memory is always an action, right? It's always a verb. It's remembering. I mean, that's what's important to me, right? It's the act of remembering, and so in some sense, it's always a performance. It's not just a matter of storage, but it's a matter of articulation. And actually, articulation, I've been thinking about this word a lot recently. It was important in cultural studies. People like Stuart Hall talk about articulation. It has two sides to it. One is the sense of articulation as a kind of speaking, right, to utter, to articulate in that sense, but also articulation as a form of connection. And I think memory is precisely that kind of articulation. It's a sort of speaking, it's a generating, a remembering. But in that act of remembering, in that performance, if you will, what you have is a connection between two different moments in time, a present and some past, or multiple pasts, as I came to think. But also, when you're connecting different pasts, you're also always connecting different places, because places don't stay the same. right? That would be, Warsaw would be a very good example of that, between the pre-Nazi period, between the ghettoization and the destruction of the city, the erection of the monument in 48. I was here in 1997 for the only first and only other time I've been to Warsaw. This spot looked very different then, right? But all of those things get linked together. And so when you cut across times, which is what memory necessarily is, you're also, I think, cutting across geographical and cultural locations. So that's a kind of performance of connection, which is also a kind of articulation.
This is what we call traveling memory today, right?
And this is traveling memory. And I guess you had asked, I hadn't been thinking about Astrid Erhel specifically in preparing for tonight, but I think what Astrid Erhel is talking about is the third, you know, this third moment of memory studies. The first moment is the early 20th century, when you have all sorts of people from Freud, to Halbwachs, and these kind of people, Proust and, you know, Warburg, and et cetera, et cetera. That's the first moment. The second moment is the moment that is around Pierre Nora and his notion of lieux de mémoire, sites of memory. And I think the break is especially clear between the second moment and what we're now calling the third moment, because the thing about Nora's vision of memory is that it was very, very much bounded by the nation and the nation state. Lieux de mémoire are the memory, or certain kind of memory, of the nation and the nation state. And what I was interested in, and it turned out lots of other people were interested in it as well, people like Astrid and Rigney, Daniel Levy and Nathan Schneider, lots of other people, was precisely memories that don't obey the borders of the nation. But for me, what's also important is that they don't obey the borders of group identity as we usually think of them. And that's sort of the third stage of my argument in the book, is that memory and identity are surely connected, but they're not connected in the way that people like Nora thought that they were. They're not connected in any kind of straight line, in any one-to-one correspondence, but the relationship between memory and identity is jagged and uneven. And mnemonic communities, right, the communities who remember are not homogeneous communities. They are heterogeneous, they don't have clear borders, they leak into each other. So Jewish memory is not just memory for Jews, just like African-American memory is not just memory for African-Americans. I think these things are shared. They're shared unevenly, of course, they're shared incompletely, but you can't close them off. You can't bound and close off identities, whether it's at the border of a nation or the border of a cultural or religious or racial group, or I think ultimately even at the borders of an individual. And that's a lesson that was already there in the first wave of memory studies. Halbwachs said that even individual memories are always collective. He had then this more reductive notion of what a collective or community was in some ways, though he also had a heterogeneous notion in other ways. So even individual memory is in some way a kind of shared memory with the various groups that we are part of. That's Halbwachs's argument. To me, that's still a powerful argument.
Thank you very much. So now to turn, we turn to Katarzyna Bojarska, who is the translator. So not only of this book, but thanks to her, we have also translations of works of Susan Buck-Morse, Dominique Lacapra, Ursula Phillips. She is assistant professor at the Instytut Badań Literackich PAN, Institute for Literature Studies of the Polish Academy of Science. She works in literature, art, and theory from the perspective of the critical theory, if I understand it correctly. She is on the editorial board of Teksty Drugie, Widok, Teoria i Praktyki Kultury Wizualnej. And she is also the author of the book Wydarzenia po wydarzeniu on Białoszewski, Richter, and Spiegelman. So now I would like you to add more words about the book. From your perspective.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me to talk. Translators usually remain mute while finished translations. I will be a little bit more testimonial at the very beginning. Michael Rothberg's first book, Traumatic Realism, was very important for my research work and my PhD thesis. That's how my adventure with his writing and thinking began. And I also translated a chapter from that one, the one devoted to Ruth Kluger, which was great, translating that. And when I was working on my PhD dissertation, thinking of how precisely how memory of the Holocaust relates to other experiences, other historical experiences, artists, writers, and visual artists, and comic book writer, in that case, in the case of Spiegelman had. I worked with both books, in a way, between those two books, between traumatic realism and multidirectional memory. But multidirectional memory was published in 2009, so it's been already seven years now, and many things changed in the global, let's say, world, in the kind of the politics of memory, also in this country, but in, and globally. And what's most important for me now, when I think about the book and about my thinking about it while working on it, is precisely what Michael was saying about the fact that our experiences and memories of events, ours as groups, but ours also as human beings, are never separate and unique. That we are somehow all connected, which is not that visible nowadays. When you think of what's called the refugee crisis and other crises, we're kind of in a state of constant crisis, state of emergency, as they call it. And this crisis of solidarity is a moment where you have to revisit the concept of multidirectional memory, of memory as such, I think. So from my perspective, the question is what memory does, or what does it make us do? What do we do with memory? What do we do having certain memories? We were discussing last night in Krakow, we were watching parts of the film, of an unbelievable film from 1961, The Chronicle of a Summer, by Jean Rouch and Edgar Morin, and we're the main protagonist in there, who is a Holocaust survivor, as we learned from Michael from his introduction, was an active member of a movement against state politics of France towards Algeria, and was actively involved in helping Algerian case. So obviously her own experience of traumatization, her own past made her open to other suffering, made her open to other people, not detached from that, from them. So this relationality is absolutely crucial, and is something that simply has to be taken to account now, you know, here and now. That's something very, very, very important. And all those case studies that we find in the book are extremely important to you know, to be taken seriously, I think. Both artistic, philosophical. Du Bois was an activist. All sorts of those accounts. Yep, that'll be it.
Thank you very much. And there is also Adam Lipschitz, philosopher and translator too, professor at the Institute of Philosophy and Sociology of the Polish Academy of Science, working in the team on post-secular thought. He's also a professor at Collegium Civitas and the University of Muri, Franz Kafka University of Muri, and the author of the book Między ludzie, koncepcje podmiotowości w pismach Harolda Bluma, and also ślad judaizmu w filozofii XX wieku. Okay, I will make it short. He has also co-translated the awarded book, the essays by Gershon Scholem, Jews and Germans, Żydzi i Niemcy. This I can translate myself. So in your last book on the Sprawiedliwość nad końcu języka, which I am really eager to hear the English translation.
Oh, justice on the tip of the tongue.
Great. you are devoted to the idea, to the thought of Walter Benjamin and the idea of justice, which is also both these ideas are central to the concept of multidirectional memory. So from this point of view, I will be asking now for your commentary.
Well, thanks a lot. Well, probably I'll come to this inevitably, but let me start from somewhere else. Thanks for this generous introduction. I'm apart from this link, this Benjamin link to this book, I'm a total non-expert to the field the book is devoted to. So I was when I was asked by Kasia to participate here, I was happy that I'll be forced to read the book. So I read it. So I just wanted to say a couple things that I why I liked this book immensely, because I did. Well, if I didn't, I wouldn't tell you. But I did like it immensely for a couple of reasons. And then I would ask you like three questions or comments or whatever, make some comments, and then I don't know. But Benjamin is definitely there, and Justice is definitely there. From what you heard, you already know what the thing is about, and probably some of you have already read the book. But there were a couple of things that I really found thrilling in the whole thing. And just very briefly, apart from two general things, which is the something that cannot be summarized, which is the detailed analysis of couple of detailed readings, close readings of very multimedia material, and all of those readings were really thrilling and convincing to me. And the second thing, which is not always connected to such close readings, which I would say a very sharp-edged moral compass, which is constantly present in those readings. And every time when I thought that you were reading something that is actually not worth reading, because it's crappy material. So for five pages, say, I was worried that you get lost somewhere in the world. Then I realized that not only you are obviously realizing that the worth of the material, but you're able to name the I would say moral quality and moral delusions that are somehow involved and somehow connected with aesthetic. Limitations of the material. So this is first class literary criticism to me. So apart from this, which as I said cannot be summarized because you have to judge by yourself by reading the book, I would say that there are a couple of things that struck me as extremely convincing and useful. From the very beginning, from the thing that you talked about the idea of going beyond the competitive modeled into the multi-directional one through things that are connected to it but are implications of this first move, such as the move you make away from abstract universalism to what's perhaps only once you call multi-directional universalism. Perhaps the term appears only once or twice in the book, but it's present almost everywhere as an idea, as a sort of specter, as a guiding moral principle, which is, as I said, already embedded in what you said, but it is a very fruitful Kantian-like ideal to a sort of idea to be to orient oneself on the idea of universalism that is not built on any abstract principles, upon any abstract principles, but which grows, if I understood you correctly, which grows through those relational networks of comparing memories, of finding how they are interconnected, how they are comparable, not really the same, but comparable, and so on, and so on, right? So one more thing that I want to mention, especially that is again just like universalism, it's not necessarily so much underlined in the book, but something that again I found very fruitful as a methodological theoretical idea. Two forms of anachronism that you are mentioning at some point. On the one hand, you are talking about anachronistic perspectives that are actually freezing history because they are jumping out of history and moving into some universal, empty universal comparison between certain moments or groups or memories, comparisons that end up with some, vague, half-empty moral judgments, but are not really producing any kind of knowledge or new perspectives, on the one hand. And on the other hand, something that is a fruitful anachronistic perspective, which actually moves history, makes history go or move again. So if you look at certain narratives that are somehow attached to nation states or national groups and are somehow already, I would say, calmed or seen as consistent, and then you take a piece of memory from one place, as Du Bois did, and juxtapose it with something completely different from some completely different time and place and space, then it may happen if you do it in aesthetically and morally right way, right? And these two are so interconnected, as I try to say in your own book and what I admired, that if you do it in a just way, right? if you do it in a right way, then you suddenly make history in both spheres, in both domains you're connecting, move again, right? Reappear, show its unexpected dimensions or aspects, right? Okay, so there are loads of things that that I enjoyed in the book. Perhaps especially the readings of the first readings of Hannah Arendt and Césaire. That was something that I was really impressed by. Not to mention the fact that I knew almost nothing about Algeria, so. I simply learned a lot. But now, three just questions or comments or ideas or whatever. I'm not sure, right? Well, one is one is connected to the thing you mentioned, that is the screen memory problem or concept, which is, this is more like a comment, I would say. I enjoyed immensely what you did with the concept of screen memory by sort of capturing it to your own project, right? Because, well, you're saying how you're showing how this concept is used by in the competitive perspective, and then you're saying, well, but screen memories actually do reveal something, but they hide something, but they also reveal what they hide, so they can be read multidirectionally. So I was thinking of moving it also over other Freudian concepts, such as condensation, such as overdetermination, and generally perhaps over. I wonder how would you think about that. Over the way Freud thinks about the way dreams are constructed or various symptoms in general are constructed, including elements from different pasts, right? Building on something that happened yesterday, but actually showing something that happened in our childhood, right, if we talk about an individual. But then I thought, and this is something that I find philosophically most thrilling in your project, I would say, that this shows what you were talking about, this complex link between identity, loosened link between identity and memories, actually shows a sort of novel vision of collective indeed, but perhaps also individual identity as a entity, as a being which always works with somebody else's memory in his or her head as well, right? So it's not only the question of putting together various moments of our own lives, but also putting together, thinking about our own memory with somebody else's voice in our head, with somebody else's memory as a comparative screen or a framework of reference. So this is just like a common, right? But then, okay, so very briefly, two things that are perhaps more like questions. One is, to what extent the project is descriptive, to what extent it is normative, to what extent you're describing mechanisms of collective memories, to what extent you're saying what it means to be just, right? What it means to do justice, right? Because I guess you're doing both in your book, but it would be great to hear you saying something about that, right? Because you have a very clear, and I can only repeat that I admired it, you have a very clear moral stance in the book, but sometimes you seem to be saying that, well, this is how it works, this is how the these are the mechanisms, but then you're moving into more, I would say, a Benjaminian mode and saying, well, if we don't do history in this way, this is unjust, okay? And here you are really going Benjaminian and say, just to be a little bit more fair to your question, and then and to link, well, there is this constant move away from smooth linear causal stories, away from them into the Benjaminian constellation-like models of putting certain pieces of memory, pieces of material into constellations rather than in causal links, right? So that's one question, and the second question is more perhaps connected to this normative moment, and perhaps even more connected to the paper that I got from Kasia, which is from Gaza to Warsaw. She was so nice to send it to me, and perhaps if you wanted to elaborate on that, I would say, I was thinking, okay, I talked too long, so I stop.
What was the third question?
Okay, thanks very much. It was very interesting. Now we will give you some time to react, and then we promise to open the floor for the audience's questions, too.
So thank you.
5 minutes.
Well, I'll be brief. I'll try to be brief. But thank you. You're right. That's fair. That's justice. Thank you both. Those were really interesting and comments and questions, I think, getting to the heart of some of the most important points. I think, and it's interesting too, especially to hear you, Adam, talk about some of these aspects of the book which I haven't thought so much about, like with your question about the performance. You know, I haven't thought so much about the universalism question in a while. I don't think I've changed my mind, but it's, you know, it's good to be reminded of that. And I haven't really talked about screen memory in a while, or anachronism for that matter. So after you've written something, you kind of, you know, filter it down to its basic components. So it's actually good to be reminded that there's much more there than I've been thinking about. And to me, that's generative. It's the thing, yeah. I think in somewhat random order, but hopefully bringing it all together. Yes, I think that there are a lot of Freudian psychoanalytic, let's say, concepts at work in the book, and because they're just in the way that I think. You know, I think so. There are things in the that I've come to realize about the book. One of them was actually this notion of articulation that comes from Stuart Hall that I mentioned a moment ago, which I don't think I ever mentioned Stuart Hall in my book, but I think this is part of my training, part of what I've internalized as a thinker and writer. And I think the psychoanalysis is a bit more present in the book, of course. It's explicitly thematized, but that it's probably even in some ways even more important because it's just fundamental to the way I read and the way I think about the self and all of this sort of stuff. A particular version of psychoanalysis, of course, that comes through literary theory and that sort of thing. I think that the way I'm reading memory is in some ways related. I know they're not identical, but it's in some ways related to the way that Freud is reading dreams, that Freud is reading symptoms. And definitely the notion of overdetermination is very important to me. And if that's not something that's familiar, basically the idea that any symbol, any image, any text, any element of a dream always carries with it multiple meanings. That's what he means by overdetermined, right? That it's kind of at the meeting point of various networks that cross each other and bring with them different kinds of meaning. And that is how I think memory works. And I think you're right that I do also think that's the way that individual memory works. So again, I'm not an expert. I certainly don't know anything about neuroscience or clinical psychology or anything like that. So I don't make any claims there, but I do think it's the way that individual memory works, and I think you're right that in some sense we always have somebody else's memory in our heads when we're remembering. And that's actually, I think, in some ways almost an obvious and banal point. Just think about childhood memories, right? How can we all have the experience of not knowing ultimately when we're honest with ourselves whether our childhood memories come from ourselves or come from someone else, usually our parents, right? So they're close to us, they're intimate, but they're not us, right? There's always an other there. And I don't think we can remember without others. So yeah, that is, to me, that is fundamental. And I think, and in some ways that gets to the question of the descriptive and the normative. Because I think in some ways, yes, I do descriptively believe that this is the way that memory works, that memory is structurally, fundamentally multidirectional, that we are, again, always remembering with others and via others and through others, and that it's impossible. I can't imagine how we would do it otherwise. And I guess what I'm trying to argue is that built on that basis of a kind of descriptive, structural multidirectionality and implication of our own memories in others, we can derive ethical and political principles. And I'm not a philosopher, so I don't know if you could really do it, make this kind of argument or how exactly it would work. But to me, yeah, it's both a description of how memory works and it's also a potential vision for ethics and politics. And I guess the question is, how do you get from one to the other? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you distinguish? And that's some of the work that I've tried to do after completing the book has been precisely to try to distinguish between different varieties of multidirectional memory, because I'm not making the argument, and I don't think I'm even making it in the book, that all forms of multidirectionality are good, mm-hmm. that they all lead to solidarity. If you've read the book or if you go to read the book, you'll see that the very first example I give is precisely the opposite. It's a very violent, competitive example about a kind of black Muslim nationalist claiming that the Holocaust, again, this sort of example I was describing earlier, has, you know, they've stolen our history. The history of slavery is much, much worse than the Holocaust, et cetera, et cetera. And my point is that is a multidirectional move, but it's not, for me at least, an ethical move or a political move that I would want an act of justice, right? It's actually an act of injustice, but it's nonetheless structurally multidirectional. This person who I'm quoting can't think of his own history outside of also the history of the other. So the question is then, how do you distinguish and what is the basis for, I mean, that's the really hard question, and that's what Kasia was getting at, this question of what memory does. How do we activate this multidirectional potential, this potential for solidarity, especially in the face of what are the obvious failures of our solidarity that we see every day in the newspaper, in social media, wherever you look to get your news. Syria is the word of the day. I think Aleppo is the word of the day. But there are many others that one could evoke. And I don't think that's the fault of memory, but it's we are implicated, and that's part of what my current thinking is about, this question of implication. How are we implicated in histories that we're not actively participating in, or that we're not perpetrators of, but that we still participate in some way, that we're linked to? That's getting in a little bit of a different direction, but Yeah, I mean, I think that question of how we get from one to the other is still a really difficult one. I don't really have a good answer to that. But what I did try to do in this essay called From Gaza to Warsaw is to try to distinguish between what I see as four different tendencies within multidirectional memory. And I used as my example, as the text that I'm reading, various analogies, and I'm sure you're all familiar with them, that link the Israeli-Palestinian question to the Holocaust. And these are often disturbing. I think they're often problematic. We also can often understand why they happen. But they also come in at a variety of varieties. And that's part of what I try to show. And that some of them are better than others, I guess, is what the way I would argue it, though people will certainly evaluate them differently. But what I try to show in that essay is that multidirectional memory can be mapped, in a certain sense, onto a grid according to two axes. One goes from competition to solidarity. That's what I call the axis of political affect. Why are we making certain kinds of comparisons in the name of competition, in the name of solidarity? And the other goes from equation to differentiation. When we bring histories together, are we equating them, or are we actually acknowledging in some ways the ways that they're different, or even over-acknowledging the ways that they're different, if that might make sense? And when you map along those two axes, you then get four positions, right, that bring together this question of comparison, equation, differentiation, and affect. Why are you doing it? Solidarity or competition? And so for me, what's, again, to go back to my model, the Du Bois example, the Negro in the Warsaw Ghetto, what you get there is a vision of differentiated solidarity. That I hope it's clear, even from the fragments that I read, that you have a vision of solidarity linking together Jews and African Americans in this case, but it's a solidarity that doesn't require equation, that doesn't require full identification, but is able to acknowledge differences of history. So that's a differentiated solidarity. But there are a lot of forms of, you know, solidarity via equation. Those are very common. And that's the kind of abstract universalism that you were referring to. Blacks, Jews, we're all the same. We've all experienced the same thing. We're all in this together. We've all suffered. Let's get out there together and, you know, and fight injustice. And I don't think that's the worst thing in the world. And there are moments when one has to speak like that, I think, to emphasize, even overemphasize, the identification between different groups. But to me, that's also, that runs into problems. And then you have the more hostile forms, which are on the competitive side. And sometimes competition is evoked through acts of differentiation. That's when I assert the extreme uniqueness of my history, right? My history is much worse than yours. It's different from yours. It can't be compared or equated with yours. That's always an act of comparison. That's one of the things I'm trying to say, but it's a form of comparison that tries to pull yourself way away from the other. But there's also a form of competition that is about equation. My history is exactly as bad as yours, right? And I don't really care about yours. I'm just using you to articulate my own suffering. And so that's what I call, you know, sort of competition via equation. So you can map these four different positions, and to me, they have very different ethical and political valences. And where I stand is clear. You know, it's on this sort of differentiated solidarity. And I think that is a form of democratic, radically democratic thinking. To me, this solidarity versus equation is a kind of liberal universalism and a kind of abstract universalism that you have in some forms of multiculturalism. And then these competitive forms are forms of nationalism of different sorts, right? I think sort of I'm separating myself from you, or I'm claiming space by, you know, by saying I'm somehow the same, but in a competitive way.
Just for a sec. I just realized that, this is just an extension of what you were saying, and I also enjoyed the essay immensely, and I found this grid very convincing and, I would say, honest, right? That you're you're saying, this is how I see it, and it works. I would say that it's simply operative. But on methodological level, this is, also normative level. I just thought that this is a very consistent but radical extension of Benjaminian methodology of thinking in constellations, of thinking about history in constellations. Because, Benjamin urged us not to think in terms of narratives or consistent causal stories, but rather constellations. But still, he was obviously thinking about one particular history of one particular culture called European culture, right? And what you're saying, his point was that writing history has this moral edge because it is about finding the singular singularity of suffering and singularity of dreams of happiness of those who perished, right? Now, what you're arguing is actually saying that you cannot capture singularity of anything without a comparative, without making a constellation between, between various streams of cultures, right, or streams of stories, right? So, and actually, so the because the ultimate goal is not to find the abstract universal level which goes beyond the singularity, but actually, indeed, do justice to the singular elements both here and there, right? But what you're saying is, as I read you, right, what you're saying is that you cannot do it. You cannot find the singularity. The paradox is that you cannot get the singularity of one thing without juxtaposing it with the other. It's
Yes, I agree. And I think
I just understood.
Yeah. No, and it does come partly from Benjamin and the constellation, which I also talk about in my first book. So yes, you're right.
Thanks very much. Now, please, can you may ask questions? Okay.
There's somebody. Thank you very much. It's hard to ask some question without reading the book, but my question is about your kind of visualization or juxtaposition between solidarity in memory and also the memory in action, what you said, or traveling memory. I have sometimes quite, it's very problematic for me, for an architect working on the nomadism, to focus on Pierre Nora or like a Connerton, which is the memory is really stuck into the place. It's quite claustrophobic and limited without any like a shadow of a political or current situation, what Yukasha said. So what is your relation between this nomadism and this traveling memory and also solidarity? Thank you.
Are there more questions for now?
As I keep the microphone, okay. May I ask a question too?
That's fine.
I like this idea of solidarity versus competition in terms of thinking about the similar past or comparative past. Solidarity is an inclination to share or an obligation to share, which sometimes is based on sharing something in the past or sharing something in the present. So in case of this solidarity field in your matrix, what do members of two different groups share? Do they share something which leads them to solidarity, or they imagine they share something that leads to the solidarity? Yeah.
Thank you. And Professor Obira?
Well, actually, I would like to say that I used your book since it appeared. And I found it extremely useful for pedagogical purposes, that including is not losing. Including is enriching. And particularly in Polish context, when we are so preoccupied in losing something, when we include other memories. Your book, exactly using French Afro-American examples are extremely useful for Polish students, that we can talk about past, about history, about Holocaust, without being afraid that facing this dark side of our own history is to be attacked. So in this sense, multidirectional memory is the memory which are opening our minds and our hearts. I don't know, it's a question, it's just saying thank you for your approach.
I think three is enough for now.
Yeah, well, let me start from the third one. Thank you.
We will continue.
No, thank you. No, that really means a lot to me. And I'm really glad to hear it. And to me, that is precisely what's at stake and what's so important in trying to think differently about these sorts of questions. Is, as you say, this notion that we don't lose, but we actually gain by certain forms of inclusion, and that kind of opening you know, I think that kind of opening is a very important gesture. And I'm not an expert on Poland, and so I've been interested in Warsaw. I've been very interested in Warsaw for a long time, but always from non-Polish perspectives, which is, I don't know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but of course it can be enriched by also including Polish perspectives. I don't have the language in some ways to do it, and that's part of what's, you know, stopped me from doing it. Yes, when I think about Poland and some of the things that I have a sense are going on, I do think precisely about some of these issues, and that the lesson is that, I mean, you have a situation where in the Second World War, where you certainly had a lot of suffering. You had suffering of different groups. And, you know, we have these figures of 3 million and 3 million, right? And so in some ways that sounds like equation, but, you know, but in fact we need to figure out how to articulate that in a way that is not equation, because they don't mean the same thing, right? 3 million Jewish Poles, 3 million non-Jewish Poles are both related, linked to each other, but also clearly have different kinds of causes and different kinds of outcomes and represent different kinds of experiences. But also then the being able to think simultaneously about oneself as a victim, but also possibly as complicit. And that's in some ways, that's what my newer work is also trying to develop more with this notion of implication, is that we're not we don't just occupy stable positions of victim or perpetrator. And I feel that as a Jewish American as well, right? I think a lot of people who are Jewish, put it that way, do like to continually see themselves in the victim position. And there's certainly a long history of victimization, and it continues in some ways. But we don't only occupy positions of the victims for various reasons. As an American, I feel that, but also as a Jew. So, you know, I think being able to think complexly about our own identities is very important. And I think in the Polish case, I can see how that would also be true. So thank you very much for your comment. I'm really glad to hear that it works pedagogically, because that's really important. That's, you know, one of the ways that our ideas are going to be extended, that they're not just abstract and philosophical, but that they can be brought to bear on a concrete pedagogical situation. And certainly it's been really meaningful to me to see how the concept has been picked up in a lot of different contexts. So people writing about Latin America, people writing about Spain, people writing about Australia, East Asia, whatever, have been working with the concept of multidirectional memory. And that's, to me, that's a sign that it has traveled, and that's what one hopes as a scholar, at least that's what I hope as a scholar, is that one's ideas travel. So that's great to hear. This question of what is shared is a really interesting and important one too. And I think, you know, if we go back to the Du Bois example, what is shared is a differentiated experience of racial violence. You know, that's the way he's articulating it. I see it as a kind of continuum that's marked by different discontinuities, right? So there's a continuum of racial violence that he's placing both blacks and Jews on. And so they do share a certain relationship to racialization, to violence based on racialization. But again, not putting them in the same spot on that continuum, but showing also how racism takes different forms. And I think that's really important. I think that's really important today. And I'm thinking here of the United States, though it's obviously true other places, where we've seen a very, for me, very frightening return of anti-Semitism at the highest levels of our incoming government and our incoming government's supporters. And I'm hoping that we can then use that as an opportunity to think about the relationship between anti-Semitism and other forms of racism, again, here in the American context, because I think that's hasn't been talked about enough in recent times. And I think this is now an opportunity, and it's also a necessity that we do this. So what is shared in the book, I think in many of the examples in the book, is often experiences of victimization, experiences of violence. Another, I didn't actually talk about it, though it was mentioned a little bit. Well, the biggest chunk of the book is actually about the context of the Algerian War of Independence in France. And what I found there, and this I knew nothing about when I started writing this book, this was really for me one of the biggest discoveries, was that, you know, during the Algerian War, 54 to 62, the people in France who were organized in resistance to it often, sometimes those who were also prosecuting the war, that's another story, but an important one, It was only 15 years or less since the war, since the Nazi occupation had ended. And many of the people who were involved in anti-war struggle or in support of the FLN, of the Algerian Independence Movement, were themselves victims of the Nazis, like Marceline Loredan, whose image is on the cover of the English version of my book, who was a Holocaust survivor, who was also, as Kasia mentioned, I think, involved in the struggle for Algerian independence, of all things. And it had only been 15 years since she'd been released from the camps when she started to do this, and she was not alone. There were a lot of people, and there was a there's a famous quotation, I no longer remember exactly the name of the person, it's in the book, who said, the torture that I experienced at the hands of the Gestapo is the same torture that I now see around me being practiced by the French state against Algerians and against French people who were opposing the French state. That's not an exact quote, but something like that. So it was often this experience of violence, this experience of victimization. I don't think that's the only way that, I don't think that violence and victimization and suffering are the only things that are shared. And probably that's not enough. You know, that there has to be something else that's also shared to create real solidarity. And maybe that's a way to start getting at the question of where does solidarity actually come from? I think it can't just come from images of victimization. I mean, I think that may be part of the problem today with, you know, how we don't, the ways that we don't respond to things that are going on in certain parts of the world or even in our own backyard sometimes. If we just see people as victims, we need to also see them as humans and therefore connected to us in other ways. So I think that's a really profound question, actually. What do we share and what is shared in these? And I don't have a full answer to it, but I think it's worth thinking more about. The question then of solidarity and nomadism, I guess for me, solidarity is always a form of nomadism. I think that's the way I'd say it. For me, solidarity is always going beyond oneself, going beyond one's comfort level, going beyond one's own identity. For it to be really authentic solidarity, it can't be solidarity with that which is the same as us, whatever that would be. It always has to be solidarity with something else, someone else, some other place, or at least to me, those are the interesting forms of solidarity. So, and it's also solidarity is created through the circulation of affects and ideas and that sort of thing. So it requires movement, I guess. If so, I don't think solidarity, you know, this goes back a little bit to your notion of freezing versus moving. And so I think if things are frozen, we don't really have solidarity. Not sure what we have exactly. So that it requires a kind of movement outwards, or at least to be an effective form of solidarity that will actually lead to some sort of meaningful action. So not just like, oh, those poor suffering Syrians or what have you, but something that would actually mobilize us, that would push us to act, to make concrete connections and not just abstract ones. Not sure if that's what you were getting at, but that's the way I would see it.
Because I just read your book, so so I just remembered.
Yeah.
No, you used the word imagine, right? And I remember just a line from Michael's book. So I just mention it. I'll just mention it.
No,
excuse me. Of course. No. There is a passage in the book where Michael stresses the role of imagination in creating those constellations, right? Which I found very thrilling, right? Fantasy is fantasy, but imagination is a cognitive tool, right? So if you, it's pretty clear that if you are trying to leave, I find it very convincing. I'm just quoting the book here, or just summarizing it, right? That if you want to go beyond, use this fruitful anachronistic method, right? And you're going beyond this frozen histories into a little bit more fluid moment, and then perhaps, to use Benjaminian vision, freeze it again in a constellation, right? To see something, you need imagination, right? You need to jump out of the archive that you already know, suddenly wake up in the middle of the night and think about another archive, which is in another library, in a different library you rarely visit, or something like that, right? So I'm just
metaphor.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah, sure.
We talked a little bit about this yesterday and in our conversations. Part of it is like the shared experience of victimization and what do victims do with their memory of being victimized or being subjected to extreme violence. The other question, of course, and the question that seems very important from today's perspective is what do the perpetrators share and what do they do with the memory? So, in a sense, you, Michael said at some point that, you know, the memory of racism does not belong to anti-racists. Okay? It doesn't. It alone. It belongs to racists. And, you know, and the racists are not people from the past. They're very much people from the present acting, using this this memory as a potential to form new forms of racist oppression, of racist racist violence. What's very important for Polish context, I think, it's not only the memory of victims and the memory of perpetrators, but as we know, there's the third figure in this kind of in the historical experience, and what do bystanders share, and therefore what do bystanders do with the memory of somebody else's oppression or on somebody else's and the violence acted by somebody else. In a sense, you know, what kind of knowledge comes out of that experience?
Would you agree that perpetrators' memories, if there are communities of perpetrator memories, because it sounds like a weird idea, but there is actually such a community, European Holocaust memories, a community of perpetrators' memory, is more oriented towards the future, whereas the victims' community, memory communities are more orientated or stuck in the past?
I don't know. That's a really interesting question. I guess, you know, I wouldn't want to, I think that's maybe a little too clear cut. I mean, I think that's a really good provocation and something to think more about and to investigate more. I mean, I guess, again, it's sort of not surprising given all that we've been talking about. For me, at least, some of these kinds of multidirectional memories of the ethical normative form, not just the descriptive form, are definitely future oriented, right? So again, I don't want to overplay any one example, but this Marceline example, again, the Auschwitz survivor who then works for Algerian liberation. I mean, she does lots of other things and changes her mind and all sorts later, so it's a complicated case. But, you know, there she is taking something from, it seems to me at least, she's taking something from the past and projecting it into some other future vision. Of justice, yeah, of justice, for sure. And not just justice for oneself, but also justice for others. So I think, you know, I wouldn't say that victim memory is always only backward looking. I think it can be, and one can understand why it would be in certain ways, a certain kind of melancholy, right? But I think if there's also mourning that takes place, or mourning can be linked to a kind of movement forward, and it can be moved to forms of solidarity, I'm not trying to also devalue melancholy. I think there's sometimes good reasons for it, and there are good reasons for dwelling on the past and not moving too quickly into the future. And someone like Jean Améry, I don't know if you've ever worked with him, but there's an idea of a kind of resentment as a powerful tool. And I agree with that. I believe in that also. You know, sometimes, so there's a kind of justified resentment which says, I am not moving past the past, because until that is my claim on justice, is to say, no, we want to turn back time in a certain sense, and we want people to undo what they have done. It's impossible on the one hand, but it's also the ultimate ethical demand for justice. So I don't think it's, I don't think it's quite so simple, but
yes,
but it's a good question.
That's actually what you mean by multidirectional memory, and when you refer to the Rappaport monument, that it has two sides, yes? So the resistance too, and what was so fascinating for Du Bois. So there is not just turning towards the past, but also this moment of activation for the future. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And there is one more voice from the audience.
Yeah, I just wanted to add one theoretical point, but I'm very confused. So I'm sorry, I just want to share it with you to just have least pressure. No, it's about the universality and the problem of sharing, because I think the it's interesting that sharing is also an ambiguous concept, because when you share something, you cut out apart, but you also you divide things, and this has double meaning. So the question would be, if two groups share something, these shared elements would be parts of their respective identity formations, or rather would it be something external to them, to both of them? And this is the question of universality. I mean, is universality the common denominator, the minimal common ground between two respective, different and exclusive sometimes, or as you perhaps prefer to say, differentiated memories? Or is it something that questions both? And I think that this problem would also lead us to the overwhelming a question of to what extent memory should be treated as the self-sufficient element, a medium in itself, in a sense, and to what extent it should be also overcome and analyzed as a strategic tool sometimes. Because I think, well, I'm heading at a very particular problem, is that there is also another way of thinking about universality that is not the traditional empty, universality of great values, etc. But it's not, this is the question, to what extent it can be articulated with your project, is something that is connected with the notion of concrete universality. And it's also used in the context of over-determination, but much more in the Marxian than Freudian sense. And that would mean, for example, that you know, in spite of thinking about, say, refugee crisis as something, you know, to what extent we can share memories of violence, to what extent we can share our goods, and so on. Why not to say that there is a common denominator, which is the system we are living in together, although we don't have the same share, of course not, but at the same time, in order to show the difference, you have to spot the common denominator or concrete universal element. And in this case, of course, the conclusion would be there is no refugee crisis. There is the system crisis. And that's the totally different discussion in which the part of memory is not that decisive, I would say.
Not that decisive.
Decisive in a sense that, you know, it's all about defining our respective memories. But because it plays a great role in all this, but very much also as a screen, I would say. You know, that is putting the attention to different places and sometimes concentrates on the on cultural differences which are not in the moment the real problem.
I think it's. Wait, is there more questions? Are there more questions?
I mean, I think it's a really profound question. I think it's a really important question. It's very stimulating to me, and I'd also be curious what you guys think about it. I think, yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with you, and I'm sure Kasia would agree as well. When we talk about the refugee crisis, that's in quotation marks, mm-hmm. and it's meant to name a certain kind of crisis, which I think we'd all agree, or in any case, I would agree, is a systemic crisis, and that's really what's at stake. I mean, there's a lot there, and it's, I don't know if I can unpack it myself or come up with something totally satisfying myself. Yes, I think that the ultimate goal, if one will, of this differentiated solidarity is not just sharing as such, but is the creation of some new sort of collective identity that goes beyond the elements that are brought together. I mean, to me, that would be the political, you know, that would be the political injunction. And so I think I am a universalist in that sense. that I see. And I think it is connected to a Marxist tradition, which has adopted this notion of overdetermination from Freud and developed it, and to me is also an important, something important. I think what's the word I wanted to add in here maybe is that of translation. That it's a, you know, and I'm thinking about some of the debates about universalism that took place, gosh, I don't know, remember exactly when, 10 years ago or something, between Butler and Zizek and Laclau and this sort of thing. And that notion of a universality, which is a concrete universality, I like that way of talking about it, and which is a product of a kind of ongoing translation, to me would be important. I think we're getting beyond the realm of memory. I think we're getting beyond the, you know, the scope of the book, of course, but I mean, I hope the book moves in some of these directions, but the book doesn't propose to answer everything, obviously. And I'm not sure we can do it here either, but I like the direction. Yeah, well, it would be great if we could.
Not this time.
Yeah. I'm thinking about this more in terms of the current crisis. I am thinking about this, you know, more in terms of what's going on today and my responses to the election of, or, you know, that guy who we won't name, and under circumstances that are still pretty unclear and strange and disturbing in so many ways. But I think that's, there've been the debates that have ensued in the wake of the election have, you know, circled around, I think, some of these same questions. Again, not really about memory, though I think actually memory is there too. We should talk more about that, but about this question of identities and different kinds of identities, and is this about class or is it about race? And there's a need, I think there's a political necessity to enact this kind of, the kind of universalism that you're gesturing at there, this kind of concrete universalism that takes into account these different social categories, such as race, class, gender, et cetera, religion, what have you, to bring them together in such a way that they're also transformed and that we move to some sort of different level. But this is getting a bit away from the topic here. So no, I don't think memory is self-sufficient. I don't know if it's something to overcome either. I think maybe that's a little bit too, that puts it back a little bit too much into a purely utilitarian framework. Right? I don't think memory is something we need to get rid of. Someone asked yesterday, it's an interesting question, is there a possibility of having too much memory? And to me, the problem isn't too much memory, which is like an accusation that's often leveled against Holocaust memory. I don't think the problem is we have too much Holocaust memory. I think in many places in the world, we have too little. But really, the question is the quality of the memory that we have and the effectivity of the memory that we have. And there are different kinds of effectivity. I also don't want to say memory is only in the service of, you know, political organization. Not at all, right? It is an extremely personal thing. It's linked to questions of individual trauma, but also individual identity, non-traumatic memories as well. So it's not something simply to use and get rid of, but it's also not self-sufficient. It's not an end in itself, for me at least.
If there is more question, we still have 2 minutes. I think there are many, many questions in our heads. Okay.
Maybe my question will be not on your book, which I used to my research and I really liked it, but the essay you mentioned, and I'm very curious to read about from Gaza to Warsaw, and I wonder if you see, because I didn't read it, maybe there is an answer there. if there is a chance to share a multidirectional memory, because the competing and excluding memories that are so burning and are so emotional, but maybe you have some kind of light in the end of the tunnel?
Yeah. I do.
I
have solved the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in this essay. It's a beautiful thing. Just no one got the message. No, I mean, I'm joking, but to me, there are, there are better ways of doing this and there are worse ways. And most of the ways are worse, you know, I think in actuality. It is, for reasons which I don't fully understand, but which I'm totally inside myself, you know, this is a particular issue that is
so quickly becomes violent, and I mean in the metaphorical sense as well as the real sense, so quickly does become competitive, is so painful to talk about within one's family, among one's friends, you know, as well as with others and those who might, you know, be the other or what have you. And I don't fully understand why that is, to be honest. But I think some of these questions of memory and their relation to identity are key to try to undoing some of that bad intensity. But yeah, I do find, you know, and again, I refer you to the essay, but I'll give you one example. It's not an totally, you know, there's no perfect solution either. But there's a work of art that I talk about in that essay that to me does do something a little bit different than a lot of these competitive, you know, violent forms of bringing together Holocaust and Israel-Palestine. It's a work by a British artist who's Jewish and also Israeli and has served in the Israeli army even. In fact, I don't know his whole biography, but that's what he sort of publicly has said, called Alan Schechner. And he does pretty controversial stuff at times. But this one piece I find moving, and it's actually related to Warsaw as well, because he takes the image of the famous boy from the Warsaw ghetto in the Stroop report that, again, we see reproduced downstairs. And he makes this kind of uncanny video loop in which that boy is shown to be holding in his hands the picture of a Palestinian boy who's being arrested by Israeli military soldiers, police, something like that, has wet his pants, you know, in fear at this moment that he's being arrested. And so the video zooms in on the Warsaw ghetto boy, and you see then he's holding this picture, and then the video zooms in on the picture of the Palestinian boy, and you see that he's holding the picture of the Israeli boy. Israeli boy, that was a bad slip. Of the boy from the Warsaw ghetto. And it's, you know, it would require more. We'd have to see it. We'd have to talk about it more. But it's certainly a vision of solidarity. To me, it's a vision of implication. And one, it's partly saying we're implicated in each other's history. His own theory of it, I find unconvincing, which is it's sort of that we, you know, that people who've suffered violence perpetrate violence on other people. I think that's way too simple. But I am moved and think there's something valuable in the way that he links these two histories without. No, I don't think you have to see it as equation of histories, though you could read it that way, but certainly in a way that creates a kind of unexpected solidarity. And it's a very anachronistic solidarity, of course, because the boy in the Warsaw ghetto could not have been holding a picture of a Palestinian boy, obviously. So anachronism, it's a moving anachronism, to go back to Adam's point there. So I think there are some examples, and I think there are other examples outside the realm of art, you know, of various forms of collaboration and connection. But I'm not an expert really on this region or this conflict. But I think we have to believe that it's possible. We have to believe it's possible. And I do think working through the memories, these related memories of traumatization and violence, but also maybe implication in one's history and even enacting of violence on both sides, those have to be confronted and worked through. So here's a place where I think memory is in fact essential. It has to go through this if it were gonna come out the other end, but there are no guarantees that we will, you know.
Thank you. Well, we are discussing, have been discussing quite theoretically and also about distant geographies. Whereas, and it's actually a good opportunity that we have the book in Polish to maybe make it more applied to the Polish context to pick up your thought. Indeed, we have Polish-Jewish memories totally polarized, divided. The memory of the Polish writers is there is no other issue that would be dividing the Polish society so strongly, whereas it could be the best example for a common Polish-Jewish memory, and it's really paradoxical. So we are very happy that we have the book here, and we are thankful to Kasia for bringing it here. I remember I was a while ago reading the text about from Gaza to Warsaw, wondering whether you have been to Warsaw yet or not, and that we definitely need to get you here to the museum facing the monument here. And then Kasia called me immediately. It was like telepathic. And she said that there is actually the real chance to have you. So we are very thankful, happy, and please buy the book and let's read it and apply here. Thank you very much. Let's